if there's in place debt that's really cheap that you can assume that's even close to 50 plus percent LTV, that's a good story in this environment. Your cost of capital is low and you're creating what's called positive leverage yield, where your going in cap rate is higher than your interest rate.
If you have over $200,000 sitting stagnant in your bank, retirement account, or home equity, then you're literally losing money. On this show, you learn how to get that money working for you consistently and conservatively. Learn to grow your nest egg with your host, Sean Winslow. Let's dive in.
Welcome back to another Multifamily Monday episode. I'm your host, Sean Winslow, and this is the Multifamily Money Podcast. What's going on, everybody? You know the drill. Every Monday, we come at you all things multifamily real estate investing. And today, I got a rock star guest who's done just that. But before I get into it, I just want to thank everybody for taking time out of your day to listen to this. I see the numbers go up and I just appreciate it, right? The point of this, I've said this before, point of the show is to give back what I've learned in this business, also share what others have learned in this business to hopefully make your path to your goals easier, your path to your dreams easier. And along the way, I hope I do bring you value. And if I have, I hope you can share it with others that might be able to get value as well. And if you have it, leave a rating and review on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify, because again, that's another way we can get in front of more people and hopefully provide them value. But for today's guest, friend of mine, Shane Carter, also based out of New Hampshire and has started his real estate career in New Hampshire like I did, and then branched out to other states also like I did. So it was kind of cool when I first met Shane. We didn't know we were both from New Hampshire. We were at an event and we just got talking. And then we found out, wait, you live in New Hampshire? You live in New Hampshire? You invest in New Hampshire? It was really cool. And like I said, Shane's a rock star. You get up to hundreds of units throughout New Hampshire, sold almost all of them. And now he's up to over 2,500 units across the country, primarily Carolinas, Florida, and Texas is where he currently owns. And so we talk about everything from, you know, how he got to start, why he transitioned out of just focusing on one state to go down to the Sun Belt, how he does that, how he manages different properties throughout different states, how he manages those teams, raising capital, finding deals. We talk a little bit of everything. This was a really fun episode to record, a really fun conversation to have. I learned a bunch. I know you will. So this is one you're going to really want to pay attention to. Probably even at some points, write something down, or if you're driving, rewind. It's a solid episode that I think you're going to love. So without further ado, here's Shane Carter. Shane, welcome to the show, my friend.
Thank you, Sean. Glad to be here.
Hey, man, I'm glad to have you. I always feel like at the beginning of these shows, when we do the conversation beforehand, where I hit record, there's always some great nuggets that land before the record buttons hit. But I know more will come. But first of all, just thanks for taking time out of your busy day. I'm really excited for this one. And the listeners are going to love it. So listeners, just let you know, there's a little connection between Shane and I, and that's that we both started our investing career in New Hampshire and have both spread outward since. But Shane's got a wealth of knowledge. He's been doing this for years, has thousands of units. So I'm excited to get into this. So Shane, if you don't mind, just telling the listeners who you are, how you got your start, and where you are today.
Yeah, sure thing. So like you mentioned, man, I do live here in New Hampshire. So like we talked about earlier, I'm sort of splitting time and I'm eventually going to be splitting more and more time in Florida, but we back and forth between New Hampshire and Florida. Because there are like, geez, probably what, 5 or 6 whole weeks that it's beautiful up here. So
yeah, that's probably being nice. Yeah.
Just kidding. So I've got a wife, 3 beautiful children, live here in bucolic New Hampshire. And my background really is sort of 25-year veteran of construction development and real estate investing. So started kind of a classic self-made man story, started real small, right? Started flipping contracts and wholesaling deals, and then got into flipping houses, and then found that I really had an affinity and a love and a passion for construction and the process of recreation. So started a GC firm and a contracting firm, and really started renovating homes and then building new construction homes and then building multi-million dollar homes and then doing community development work and townhomes, condos, et cetera. And also got into land entitlement, which we'll touch on. That's the only part of the business of that world that I still do today is land entitlement, land development. But those are all transactional cash businesses. So I always took the money I made and bought multifamily assets, value add multifamily, where my own guys could do the work. We'd fix them up, refi them, hold them, and sort of built my knowledge of the business and backbone of the business that way. Did a couple of JVs with 1 or 2 groups that brought money to the table. and capacity to the table when I wanted to buy 120 unit plus complexes here in New Hampshire back in the day. And really that's sort of how I grew my capacity and then really pivoted just before COVID to getting into the national multifamily scene and really investing in the Sun Belt regions of Texas, Carolinas, and Florida is where we focus. And so in the last 2 years, we've acquired a little over 2,000 units, about $250 million in AUM, and looking to actually double that this year, which I know is tough given that it's almost April and Q1's just about over. And it's a pretty tough buying environment right now.
Yeah, that's for sure. Most of the deals, I don't know if this is similar for you, but most of the deals I've seen so far, not all, but most have been deals that were recycled from last year that they just couldn't sell.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of that. A couple of quasi-troubled deals. And mostly another interesting one where it's sort of a partnership dispute, but we dug into the numbers. They're like, you know, they're basically asking top dollar for it, right? So there's no necessarily great basis story. That's really one of the key fundamentals that we're looking at right now. Is there a good basis story?
So what made you make that pivot? You were all in New Hampshire, hundreds of units, and then you decided to go national. And now you're thousands of units. What was the driving force behind that?
Yeah, good question. So it was something I look back on, no regrets, right? This is all just path in life that we all get to take. But I wish I had jumped into the national scene sooner and I sort of held myself back from doing it. Let me rewind first and set the stage a bit better. I had set goals for myself, let's say 20 years ago, right? Then when I achieved my transactional cash goals and my net worth and sort of asset holding goals, and I acquired my property that I live on now. It's 150 acre farm. It's got tons of rolling fields and farms and ponds and great place to raise kids. It sort of, I had achieved my goals, right? And so I kind of sat back on my laurels and just coasted there for a number of years. And that's my regret. And so that's the answer to why I transitioned is because I knew there was another level for me. There was another level that I needed to explore in myself personally, professionally, or otherwise. And I knew that I wasn't going to achieve it by sort of continuing to focus locally. And so that was my big aha moment, is that I realized that I was complacent. And complacency is not a good place to be as someone who's a growth-minded individual and wants to continue to expand, has a learning growth mindset, and wants to be able to be all that I could be essentially, right, in my life. And so that was my big aha moment, is that I needed a new direction. I needed new passion. I needed new goals. And I needed a new sort of fire under my butt to get me moving.
Yep. The mind can be a powerful thing. Sometimes we don't even know that that's the reason that's what's holding us back. But it's for sure, like I've told this story countless times on here. It's I got over to 400 units in a year and a half, but it took me another 6+ years to actually make myself take the action to do that. Right. So it's a total of 7.5 years to get there, even though for 6, I didn't do anything. But that's because that was a mindset thing.
Yeah.
Thought I needed to know more, thought I needed to be older, more established, more money. That's just not the case. And I'm glad you shared that, because I think a lot of people need to hear that. They're not the only ones with those mental stumbling blocks that need to get over.
Yeah, no, it's all mindset. Now that I sit in the place that I'm in now and look back on my life so far and the things I did well and the things I didn't do well, the only reason that it's taken me so long to get where I am is not because I've acquired all these years of wisdom. Well, I guess it is in my own case, because that's what it took for me to get here.
Yeah.
But it's because I didn't have the right mindset, right? Just like you explained, Sean, I've explained to people so many times, one of the big kind of shining memories in my past, people say, Shane, how did you get to be who you are or where you are? And ultimately, it came down to this sort of one defining moment where I tell people I was sort of subconsciously waiting for someone to let me know that I was worthy and that I was capable and that I could now achieve this, that I had arrived to be able to do so. And it was really just myself. I needed to anoint myself as worthy. And so once I did that, everything changed, doors opened, the path became effortlessly rolled out before me, right? And so that's the big mental shift, is knowing that you're worthy, knowing that you can do it, and convincing yourself mentally that's where you need to go. That's it.
It's true. The opportunities and resources are there for you. You just need to be open, like you said, to receiving them, and then it all comes.
Yeah.
No, that's great. So I imagine, Shane, part of your success early on building what you built in New Hampshire was because you were local, right? So you're established there, you could get eyes on your different projects, were able to maintain controls. How have you been able to, you know, not lose that by going to all these different states?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's not easy. It takes a lot of systems and processes. And that's really where my partner and I, Nick, have really focused a lot of our initial time in building the company is around those systems, processes. You know, we use EOS sort of traction and, you know, really diligently understanding and managing those KPIs. But something else that is really important that we didn't do initially in the business right off the bat, but now we do very, very consistently, is we both physically travel to all of these sites, all of these locations, and inspect what we expect and show up and see people eye to eye, face to face. And that's critical. We have local employees in all these places, yes. But even then, you still, as the owner, you need to show up. You need to show people that you're there and that you care and that you're going to physically be there. That's the part of it that is difficult to do from afar, right? I can't just hop in my car and go drive 30, 45 minutes or an hour to get to these places. It's more of like a case of our Texas assets. It's a 3.5 hour flight,
right?
It's a 2-day process. Get there, see the assets, stay overnight, see some more assets, and then fly back home to New Hampshire. It's a full 2 days out of the week to make that trip. But we're 100% committed to it. Nick and I alternate, and that's really, really important.
The boots on the ground employees, I'm assuming this is kind of like a regional player, not necessarily on-site staff.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we have on-site staff, obviously, at every property, but we have asset managers, we have construction management, and they're sort of in charge of those verticals. Asset management, obviously, is overseeing the assets. And so, yeah, it's their job to physically go touch and see the assets, check on the culture of the site staff, make sure that the motivation is there and the morale is there, as well as, obviously, the physical upkeep of the property, in addition to managing those data points and those KPIs at the assets.
How are you able to find these individuals, these regional boots on the ground players? I'm sure there's others listening that probably want to do the same thing, but obviously can't just hire anyone. What has been your kind of strategy to finding these individuals?
I mean, look, we work with professional HR and staffing agencies. They're not cheap, right? We pay a healthy fee to get these folks, but it's worth it when you look at what is the turnover cost, right? What does it cost to have a bad employee? What does it cost to have things not go well for a key hire? Those expenses for getting key personnel, and we're, you know, these are all obviously six-figure plus employees, right?
Right.
And so for us, it was a relatively easy decision to know that the cost of acquisition of that key employee paled in comparison to not having the right folks in there or having to replace them within a year or two.
Yeah. What type of background are you looking for in these individuals?
Yeah. So I think, obviously, experience in commercial real estate asset management. I think we've identified an avatar too that has maybe a more of an institutional background, but has a personality type that they were able to perform in their job at an institutional level asset manager, but would more engage or would thrive better in more of an entrepreneurial environment, right? Which is what our company has. We're a small entrepreneurial feel environment where every voice, every hand on deck really, really matters and has a huge say in the direction and success of the company. And so tying profit sharing and their direct ability to affect profit at the entrepreneurial level of the company is really, really intriguing to a lot of folks who are doing this job, but doing it for a major corporation where there necessarily aren't those freedoms and potential benefits of profit.
Yeah, I think it's important to be aligned. And also, of course, from like a performance standpoint, but also just that you're aligned as culture too. I think that's huge.
Culture's everything.
So you went almost sold all your units in New Hampshire to now over 2,500. How do you find these? Are these through brokers, direct to seller, combination? How are you guys sourcing your deals?
Yeah, it is by far and away all mostly through brokers, right? Yeah. And really fostering those relationships. The brokers are the ones who generally are going to have those direct relationships with the buyer or the seller groups, the ownership groups that we would want to transact with primarily, because our focus is really 150 to 450 unit size. So you're generally not seeing too many mom and pop ownership groups in those assets, especially in the major MSAs that we focus on in those Sunbelt markets. So really, it's all broker relationships and getting to know them well, for them to get to know us well, know our capacity, know our capitalization structures, knowing who we are, what we do, our track record. And then obviously, once you're a proven closer and you close one and then you close three and then you close seven, people know that you're a closer. That really speaks volumes.
No, yeah. And really, it's true. It depends what you're trying to buy, right? So like some smaller multis, direct to seller makes a lot of sense.
That's sure.
Going to be mom and pop. But to your point of 150 plus, especially in major metros, that those are usually either other private firms or institutional players. So they're going to go to brokers. Yeah. So,
yeah.
And it's all about this business, is no matter what aspect you're talking about, is about relationships, and especially with brokers. At the end of the day, one, yeah, they want to make sure you can transact. So that's number one. But two, they also just want to do business with people that they enjoy.
Yeah.
Like I've had plenty of conversations where it's like, yeah, I've transacted with this guy before, but he's a real pain. He's not a nice person. So I'd prefer not to transact with this guy again. Even though I know he can close, I just don't want to do it.
Yeah.
It's about just having a healthy relationship with these brokers, just being a good person. And then they, that's easy as it is, right? So
yeah. And unfortunately, it's not something that you either are or you aren't, right? And I think we've all seen there's lots of different personality types in these business. And yeah, like you, man, I prefer to just be around and communicate and engage and do business with people who have a relatively high emotional intelligence, right? And are self-aware and understand that business is business, but at the same time, it doesn't always have to be difficult, right? In fact, you can choose for it to be relatively easy.
Now, for someone that may be in the same situation you were, where they were really honed in on one market, build up a solid portfolio, and now they want to break into another market, how were those initial conversations with the brokers? Was it just because you obviously hadn't transacted in that market yet? Was it just explaining who you were, what you'd done?
Yeah, that's it, right? It just explaining who we were, what we had done. And sure, Nick and I have a combined background and sort of bed of experience that is not necessarily like most two-year-old companies. I've been doing this for 20 plus years. He'd been doing it for 15 plus years. We'd done thousands and thousands of units between us in our careers before we joined forces and started this company as a newly formed entity a couple of years ago. So that added color to the conversation that we had this track record of experience prior to forming the company. But even if you don't have that, really what I would focus on is why you're expanding into that market, you know, sort of impress or explain to the broker why you've selected the market. What are those key metrics that you've keyed in on as to why you're in that market? It's all the same Kool-Aid, they'll already know, but they want to hear it from you that you understand and you're not just sort of shotgun approaching this business, that you're targeted, that you're focused, and that you have a very keen, specific buy box, right? And I think that leads a lot of credence to groups too, when they explain to brokers that they have a very niche focus, the very, very small focus in terms of what they want to buy. In other words, hey, we'll buy anything from 1950 to 2018. That's not going to feel as good to a broker as we're really only focused on 1985 to 2005, right? Or 70s and 80s value add, or whatever you want to call it. And again, defining what that buy box is, either in terms of unit count or transaction volume. Hey, we really like to be under 30 million in transaction volume because, generally speaking, we like to solve equity checks that are in that $5 to $8 million range. Or in our case, we won't go below 30 million. Our transaction size is really sort of 30 to 100 million. And for similar reasons in terms of the equity that we align ourselves with.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, they don't want their time wasted either, right? So you're not being concrete, that could be a waste of their time. They're not just going to send you everything and just let you kick it around. And that's also why they actually are more appreciative when you tell them you don't like something than when you do, because then they know, okay, I'm not going to send them this anymore.
Yeah.
That's something I try to tell everybody, is it can be hard to constantly tell them no, but they appreciate it. They actually do appreciate it when you tell them this is not for us and then tell them why.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, they'll respect you much, much more, right? Because let's be honest, whatever deal they're showing you, if you're, it's a new relationship, you are not the first person to see that deal.
Oh, heck no. Yeah.
Which means you are not the first person to say no to that deal.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you act all super excited about it and you're so grateful to see this opportunity, unless it is an amazing opportunity, in which case I would question, why hasn't somebody else bought this, right? I would always want to dig in on that. But yeah, when you say no, it sort of gives you that respect as well, that, okay, these guys aren't just newbies who don't necessarily know what they're doing, and they're not just excited to get a deal flow and they're just going to offer whatever they can offer on it. They're savvy investors and they are very strict with their buying criteria, and they know what they want and they know what fits.
Yeah. It gives you credibility.
Yeah.
It also allows them to bring more ammo back to the seller to let them know that maybe this, the price they want is not realistic. Because I'm sure you do too, Shane. I have brokers that tell me just to submit, like, I will never submit on something I don't want to buy. But what I mean is I'll submit at a number that I'm comfortable with, even though I know it's not close to what the pricing guidance was. And they'll just tell me to submit because they need that data to show the seller.
Yep. The other things we've done, obviously, we're going back into sort of more of the frenzied buying time of the market, right? 2020, 2021, 22.
Yeah.
Yeah. We weren't afraid to necessarily go hard day one, right? And sort of put that money on the table and sort of let those brokers know and let that buyer group know or seller group know that we're serious and we know we can close and we're putting our money where our mouth is. We don't necessarily have to do that in today's environment, but I mean, that was something that definitely was in our favor, that we were never afraid of doing that and afraid of our ability to close, right? And so we came out pretty hard day one with the ability to do that. And also we acted very, very quickly. Right. So when we had a deal that made sense, we learned how to screen deals quickly and how to get to numbers that if this deal made sense, I was literally on a plane the next day.
Yeah.
Right. I was fast getting in there. Here's the LOI. I'm on a plane. I'm touring. Let's go to PSA.
Yeah. Well, it's all about speed, right? Because
it's all about speed.
Can't let others get in there. And if you can give them the price and the terms, obviously that are good for you as well, then yeah, you got to lock that up because to your point, it's quickly going to get down the rung of who sees it really fast if you're passing on it. And at the end of the day, brokers eat what they kill. So the faster they get a deal done, the faster they're going to get paid.
Yep, exactly.
That's great information to share. And yeah, in terms of the hard money, unless it's a 1031, I haven't seen it recently. I haven't been told that I need to do it to be competitive. So, which is good, right?
Yeah.
Good from a buyer standpoint. We're just talking about how crazy hot New Hampshire is right now. So I've still seen some crazy numbers and crazy terms. Actually, I've seen it in Georgia too. We recently submitted on a deal where we were about 11% off the highest offer. And Shane, it's just like, what? These numbers don't make any sense. Like, is it these people know something I don't know, or is it just they don't know what they should know? It's just crazy. And this was a deal that we've transacted with this group before. So I was one of the first, if not the first, to see this deal like months ago, like in August. And before they even really had it signed up, I got to take a look. And then it slowly came out. And they didn't list it at first. They just sent it to their short list. And I made an offer. They didn't like it. So then they wanted to season a little more. And then it just came out to market like earlier this month. And they've had offers, two or three offers that are 10, 11% above where we're at. It still doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Well, maybe people have a different cost of capital, right? I think capital structure really can affect people's buy box and what they're able to pay for things, right? If you have a huge bucket of capital and all you have to do is give it a 10% return, you can potentially pay more for a property, right? And still make everyone happy with the performances, given that your capital is a sort of fixed return or capped at a certain return or only been told it's going to get a certain return. So that's something that we're working on as an eventual bucket is how do we get our sort of globalized cost of capital low enough where we can really compete at institutional levels and 10,000 plus unit levels. It's hard though. This environment's tough. I mean, look, we're screening deals nonstop. We say no to well over 95% of everything we see, even in the screen, right? Before we even get to a full underwrite. And it's because in this environment and knowing our equity and what they want to see as well, if there isn't a good basis story, right? So I think first half of late 22, early 23, the story has to be, look, I'm getting this at an amazing basis, right? In other words, the price per door, the price per square foot, whatever metric you want to use, there's just a clear story here as to why this is an intelligent buy. And as we all know in real estate, you never get a second chance to make a first good basis play, right? So however you buy an asset really can affect its ultimate realization of value. And so now's a great time to be very, very strict with the basis and the price per unit, price per square foot, however you want to look at the deal. And then is there great in-place debt? Because interest rates are in the 6, 7% range. And that's for fixed rate agency and forget about bridge debt, right? And other types of products, CLO. But if there's in-place debt that's really cheap that you can assume that's even close to 50 plus percent LTV, that's a good story in this environment. Because again, your cost of capital is low and you're creating what's called positive leverage yield, where your going in cap rate is higher than your interest rate on your capitalized product. So that's something that we're real focused on. And that's tough to do, right? When everything's in 6, 7% interest rate, but cap rates asking going ins are still in the fives. So it's really tough to see that work. And we're super focused on yield on cost. That's a metric that we really, really drill in on. And we really need to see that spread on yield on cost through the life cycle of the investment. That's really, really important to us. But, you know, those are some of the things that we quickly screen and get to a quick no on for a lot of deals, right? And then if it does get past that screen, well, now we're super focused on the neighborhood demographics, the household income, the rent story. That's the very next thing we go into is the rents, right? And what's the rent comp analysis? What's the rent story here? And what's the average effective rent in place versus the pro forma? And can we fundamentally add value? Can we increase NOI by 50% in 3 years? If we can do all those things, then goes on to the next phase of iterations of revolving around a good offer. But yeah, it's tough to make them all work right now.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. That's a solid initial screen too. So I appreciate you sharing that. And I feel like the rent thing is something that's often overlooked, right? And overlooked in the sense of people do it, but I don't think they do it correctly, or they just do it quickly and move on, right? They look at CoStar if they have access to it, which is a lagging indicator, right? Or they, whatever metric they use, but actually intimately knowing, like, does that actually make sense? Because to your point, Shane, like the neighborhood, say a $1,500 per month for a 2-bed in this neighborhood makes perfect sense. But 3 blocks down the road where your property you're looking at is, it doesn't make sense. And you really need to know that. Maybe you only can get 11 there. Yeah. That could really blow up a deal if you're underwriting that $1,500. And I think that's something that a lot of people overlook. They just plug and play into a spreadsheet. Oh yeah, we're going to get this number and then it's going to be 5% rent growth, which please don't do that.
And they don't measure that pro forma rent against the average household income of the neighborhood, right? To ensure that it is a 3x or lower. And they don't test that so that they're underwriting to $1,600 a month rents, but the average household income is $40,000. Like, that's just not going to work, right?
Right. No, it's so true. And
the affordability's off there. And the other thing we look at too, and you're so wise to key in on the rent comp analysis, because that's where we spend all of our initial time, because it's all about that rent growth. It's all about that rent analysis and getting really, really good at telling that story in your rent comp analysis. Is our story is we never want to be the rent leader.
Yeah.
Right. So whether that's per square foot or the nominal rent, we never want to be the rent leader. There has to be somebody else already in front of us pushing that pro forma rent. And then we want to come in and trail that. And we want to be in that sort of 75th percentile on our pro forma rents when at all possible. And that's sort of like a guaranteed cushion against anything that would pull back from that bleeding edge of where the market rents are for any given asset. And so that knocks us out on a lot of deals, right? Because other people are willing to say, hey, these guys are at 1800, we're going to go to 1800. And our underwriting says, no, we're going to go to maybe 1700, maybe 1725 at most, and keep that $7,500 rent gap between our product and theirs, even though we're renovating to the same or higher standard. It's just a value proposition. We want baked in conservatism. We want baked in protection against downside risk of any potential pullback. And then again, on the B-class product that we're looking at predominantly, we'll look at what is that rent gap to A-class. And what's the deliveries, right? What's coming into the market over the next 1 to 3 years in that 1 to 3 mile radius? And what's that gap to A class or gap to new build? Again, it's got to be a substantial gap, right? It's got to be $400 or $500 a month difference between your sort of B class renovated product and your A class new development product, or else there's not really a good story there, right? There's going to be too much crossover and it's potentially going to affect your product and your rents you're going to be able to achieve.
Yeah, at the end of the day, that's your revenue, is your rent. And if you can't forecast that properly, then there's a lot that's going to go wrong.
Yeah.
Now, this is great, Shane. This has been a masterclass in initial screening of properties and neighborhoods. So love it.
Yeah.
You mentioned the capital stack, and sometimes people have access to cheaper capital, essentially.
Yeah.
We've been spoiled, and by we, I mean investors have been spoiled over the last 3 years, getting 15 to 20% IRR, like it's nothing, you know, average returns of 16% plus. Where do you think we're at right now in terms of, are these investors becoming more realistic that probably is going to be pretty hard to find? Where, in your opinion, where do you think like a comfortable or an adequate range is that investors should be looking for? And I know it's going to differ per market and property type, of course, but.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And it's still just like sellers, right, are still needing to adjust their parameters and understanding of valuations and cap rates. I think investors and LPs are still sort of adjusting as well. Yeah. There's going to be a time lag and gap to that, but I think we're in it. And I think let's break it down by asset class, right? I think for A-class stabilized investments, I think if you're in that sort of 12 to 14% IRR range, all of these numbers I base on a 5-year straight hold, no refi, right? Just a clean analysis with a solid cash on cash that is maybe a little bit lower year one, but sort of grows into that 6, 7, 8% range through the life of the product for an A-class investment. I think that's great because it's a safer asset. It's a safer class. And you have to weigh that against what are your other alternatives for that type of risk-adjusted return and for that kind of safety, certainly above what you're going to achieve in a bond or equity type scenario.
Right.
With I would certainly suggest a much greater security metric in terms of asset-backed investing. So that's what I think for that. And then on the sort of B and C class value add product for multifamily, I think it obviously the range is a bit above that, but I think in that sort of 14 to 18% range, again, is where people should shake out. I mean, I don't know that 20% IRRs are really going to be achievable in a stabilized, normalized investment cycle. And I think those IRRs are actually really, really solid. Again, with good operators, good business plan, and a good basis story, and a good rent story, good rent growth story. If all those things are conservative, I think there are absolutely going to continue to be deals that get 20% plus IRRs. But this is an execution business, and you like to leave upside from the execution side, but sort of under promise, over deliver. But I think those are appropriate ranges, I believe.
Yeah, and historically, those are very solid returns. And I think that's why private equity and other institutional players that I've talked to over the last few years still have just maintained that range because, well, one, it usually with a higher return, there's some risk associated with that, right? So they just want a solid risk-adjusted return. They want that 15% IRR. Historically, that's been attainable. So yeah, I'm with you. I think that's where it needs to come back to. And to your point, yeah, it could happen that everything could go perfectly and you get a nice pop of a 20 plus percent IRR, but I don't think that's what you should be shooting for, or you shouldn't be passing on a deal that is not projecting that. And if a deal is projecting that, I'd be kind of skeptical about that out of the gate.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, unless there's some amazing basis story and you take a look at that rent comp analysis and you're like, yeah, they're sufficiently conservative in that rent growth story and in that pro forma rent relative to the comp set. Yeah, they're only projecting a 3% annualized rent growth and a 2% increase in expenses. And okay, that all feels conservative, right? But if you start seeing those 7-8% annualized rent growth numbers and look sideways at that for sure.
All right, before we run out of time, I want to get into just quickly, you mentioned to me that this is obviously still one of your main businesses acquiring multifamily properties, but you mentioned you're getting into a little, you've done this in the past, but you're starting to bring it back into play. And that's a land development place. Let our listeners know what that's about.
Yeah. So I've been doing land entitlement work for just about 15 years now, mostly just here in New Hampshire. But last year we started to branch out and got some projects in South Carolina. And we're working on 3 in Florida right now and a couple in Texas as well. And it's really just taking raw land and getting it fully entitled, shovel ready, not just the underlying zoning. Like people say, hey, this is entitled for 200 units of multifamily. Well, it's zoned for that, but you don't have a shovel ready project, right? You didn't do the engineering. You didn't do the architecturals, you didn't do the road design and all of the full work that it takes, all the studies that are required by the municipality or the county or city. And so we do all that work and at risk and take it through that and full entitlement project to get a shovel ready project. And what we found is there are a lot of regional and especially national buyer groups that just want shovel ready projects. They would be happy to pay you a fair and reasonable price to get a shovel ready project because it takes that in New Hampshire and New England, shoot, it's at least 12 months, probably 18 to 24 months I've seen in my own experience to get something through that process to become fully entitled. And so that's years of your life and hundreds of thousands of dollars of brain damage and pulling your hair out and going before boards and negotiating, getting your project delayed another month and so on, and angry abutters coming out. It's a whole thing that ultimately we're trying to actually provide housing, which is in dire need all over the country. Specifically here in New Hampshire, we have a real critical need. It's a challenge to get it through the regulatory process. So our business model is to very niche down and focus on that entitlement process and provide a lot of value to end developers who ultimately they don't want to do the entitlement process. It's a necessary evil. They're happy to buy a shovel-ready project, move in their dozers, excavators, start laying utilities and start getting lots gone for single-family homes or building ground-up multifamily, industrial. But those are the three assets we focus on: single-family, multifamily, industrial.
Awesome.
But yeah, it's a fun business. It's an interesting business. Not a lot of people focus on it. And yeah, I enjoy it personally.
Yeah, you get paid a premium for that brain damage, right? So
sure. Yeah, you have to, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, I think being a developer myself and understanding those horizontal vertical costs makes me a great land entitlement specialist because I know how to leave meat on the bone for the next guy. I know how to make sure that the price that I'm charging for that fully entitled shovel-ready project is going to be a good buy for that land developer, for that developer to come in and say, oh, heck yeah, this makes a ton of sense for me to buy at this price.
Yeah.
And so that allows me to back into what can I pay for the land, right?
That's a good point. And so are you just networking in these markets to define the developers? Or are they more national developers that will just go anywhere?
Yeah. So just like multifamily, I'm relying heavily on, I've got a couple of key JV partners in those markets that are well-respected, really intelligent, you know the business, already know development and or surveying engineering that are sort of tied in with that and or, you know, some of the, frankly, the political environment that it takes through some of these county commissions, planning committees, et cetera, cities to get these entitlements approved and sometimes get things rezoned for approval. And so I've been pretty selective in who I JV and partner with on that and apply my system and process of having done this here with their local knowledge to create a really beneficial system for both of us. And so it's working great in South Carolina. And again, we're just sort of coming out of the ground with three projects in Florida and kicking it off in Texas as well this year.
There you go. And I bet those states have less headaches than New Hampshire.
Yeah, much less. Yeah, the development, the entitlement process is effectively in half. It's half the time.
Wow, that's crazy.
Which again is why we have this housing issue in the Northeast and
right.
We have less and less housing issues in the Sun Belt and why it's expanding and has all this energy and is attracting all these jobs and businesses and people is that they're solving their housing issues better.
Yep. That's why we focus a lot. Like you, we still do business in New Hampshire, but we focus a lot in the Sun Belt too. It's just a trickle down effect. When you can provide more housing, provide a lot of other things like jobs. So
yeah,
it makes a lot of sense. All right, Shane, I don't want to take up too much of your time. So before I ask you the final four questions, where can listeners find you if they want to get in contact?
Yeah. So our website, hampshire.capital. I'm on Facebook, LinkedIn, Shane Carter, NH. By all means, reach out, look me up. Happy to connect with folks and like-minded individuals. And obviously, always happy to help anyone that I can.
Awesome. All right. Final four. I guess that it's basketball season, right? So.
All right. Final four. Let's
final
go.
Four. Here we go, right? All right. First one. Why multifamily as an investment vehicle? And what kind of life has it provided for you?
All right. So why multifamily is really because I believe it is the most evergreen and risk resilient asset class. Medical office, industrial, all of these have been great investments in the near term. They might be great investments in the long term, but one thing we know for sure is that housing and multifamily is absolutely a very, very risk resilient investment class through all major down cycles and really just throughout history. Nothing's going to come along and replace it. People always need a place to live. And so to me, that's why I've settled in that asset class for ownership reasons, even though I do have a few other holdings diversified into a couple of those other asset classes I just mentioned, but it's 95% multifamily. The kind of life it's provided for me is, I mean, look, I've been self-employed guy for 25 years. So I've always sort of been focused on a freedom mindset and the ability to sort of be free in what I do, how I choose to spend my time. But it certainly allowed me the freedom to not only experience life on my own terms the way I want, but to be really, as I get a little bit older in life and I have three kids, to be really, really present and very, very focused when I have that time with my children. It's very short that they're sort of with us before they grow and leave. And so I've never missed Cub Scout meeting or an event or a sports event or anything like that. And I never will, because that is my freedom, is that I never have to be beholden to anyone else. I can choose to do what I need to do with my time when I need to do it. And so that to me is, that's irreplaceable freedom.
Time is one of the most valuable things. That's the thing we can't buy more of. So it doesn't matter how much money you have.
Absolutely.
All right. Number two, what is a common mistake you see real estate investors make?
Common mistake. Yeah. Look, I made it myself. So I'm going to talk from experience here, which is one of the biggest mistakes that I made earlier in my career, in I'd say the last 7, 8 years or 10 years anyway, is not being hyper-focused, not being really, really focused and having a very almost niche level focus on what you do and becoming an absolute expert in that niche. And so as a entrepreneur mindset person, I've made money doing all kinds of things, right? And sort of shiny object syndrome. Oh, I can make money doing this and doing that and doing this and doing that. But when you become an expert and get super hyper focused on a very specific niche, that's when true success starts to come to you.
Right. Yep. Get away from that shiny object syndrome. Just put eye blockers on.
You have to learn to say no a lot.
Yep. All right. Number three, what is a resource that you'd share with someone who either A, wants to get into this business, or B, maybe a resource where someone's established but wants to grow? And that resource can be a book, a podcast, mentor, whatever it may be.
Sure, sure. Yeah. I mean, some great books. My sort of first two foundational books were Think and Grow Rich and then 12 Pillars by Jim Rohn. I continue to go back and reread those. They're sort of like my Torah and Quran or Bible or whatever holy book you want to call it. Those are my go-tos, sort of reread every year, in addition to all the other books that I'm consuming. But honestly, man, for podcasts, for all I would say is find your tribe, find something that resonates with you, whether that is in a mastermind event, which by the way, I'm a huge fan of, getting a mentor, get into a mastermind group, get into communities, listen to the podcast, if that is a way to get you into one of those communities. There are a number of them. And really, it's all about the networking. It's all about the expansion of the mind and networking and really being able to grow yourself within that network of like-minded individuals. So I can't necessarily give you a specific one that I would suggest over others. I don't have any for sure, but I know that that was instrumental to my success as well, is really just finding my tribe and getting into that like-minded group of folks that can really elevate the entire group together.
Yep. Hey, your network is your net worth. So make sure you're creating a quality one. All right. Final question. And Shane, so I do 2 episodes a week. First, every Monday, Multifamily Mondays, and every Friday. So I have a background in finance. So I do every Friday, I do Finance Fridays. So think of like personal finance. So it's the good old time machine question. So if you had a time machine, go back to younger Shane, give him a piece of financial, personal finance advice that you think would set up his life differently, what would that be?
Wow. You know, I've thought about this, which I don't spend too much time thinking about it.
Right. We're talking about it.
I have no regrets.
Right.
But yeah, look, if I had to do over again, it's certainly what I teach my children. My 14-year-old has had an investment account since he was 8. Right. Yep. So made him a minimum of 10% of everything that he has ever made in terms of doing chores and anything, any money he's ever made, he's had to put in an investment account, which I manage and I give him returns on.
I love that.
I've sort of taught him how his money, now he's got thousands of dollars in it. Right. And it produces this passive income monthly for him. And he's an 8th grader. So I'm sort of teaching him that. So I guess I would have taught myself that earlier. And also, I think my path was that I got into construction. I got my hands dirty. I really fell in love with it. I got to know structures and buildings and how to put them together. And that ultimately is a unique characteristic as to how I'm a good owner operator of assets now. However, I don't know that that's necessarily the best path. That was a sort of dirty, gritty, hard scrabble way to go about it. Yep. If I were to talk to my younger self, I would probably encourage him to really focus on, there's two things that everyone always needs more of in this business, and that's deals and money. And if you focus on the money and you focus on being really good at attracting money, raising capital, and being an intelligent steward of capital and investing in intelligent deals with other operators that really know what they're doing, that is absolutely the best sort of risk reward profile that I would encourage my younger self to have gotten into.
Oh, I love that. All right, man. Well, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. This has been an awesome episode.
My pleasure. Anytime.
All right.
Always good to chat.
Yeah. And listeners, I know you got some value out of it because I did. So as always, easy doesn't pay well and instant gratification is self-destructive. So not only get out there and work hard for your money, but have it work hard for you so we can create the lives of our dreams. And that's the way to make this world a better place. All right, everybody. Catch you on the next one.
Hey, this is Sean Winslow. After being in the financial service industry for years and having candid conversations with good people just like you, I realized that so many of us are wanting an investment strategy that provides solid returns and consistent income without the bumps in the road. There's little known secret that your financial advisor doesn't want you to know. There is an investment out there that is less volatile and the returns are stronger. Get more details by going to greenbriercg.com and clicking on the free e-report. And by the way, if this show has provided you any value, then feel free to leave an honest written review and of course, share it with a friend who needs it. See you next week for another great show.